From the KTOO newsroom in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Krumrie. Thank you for tuning in this afternoon. The massive budget reconciliation bill the U.S. House delivered to the Senate would block Medicaid patients from receiving care at Planned Parenthood health centers. And healthcare providers and advocates in Alaska are afraid that would prevent many Alaskans from getting critical healthcare. Rose O'Hara Jolly is Planned Parenthood's Alaska director and facilitated a roundtable Monday with providers and advocates in the state. They say many Alaskans on Medicaid who go to Planned Parenthood clinics now may have no other option.
The loss of Planned Parenthood would further exacerbate the need for people to travel across Alaska to receive care. Residents in rural Alaska who already face barriers to care will be the most affected.
The state has two Planned Parenthood clinics in Anchorage and Fairbanks, which provide preventative sexual health care, cancer screenings, contraception, and abortions. Abortions made up about 4% of all services at the clinics across the country last year, according to their annual report. The Juneau Planned Parenthood closed late last year, and O'Hara Jolly says providers in the area report that they haven't been able to fully absorb the health needs of former patients. Josie Hayano is a social worker, an advocate for those harmed by human trafficking. She says Planned Parenthood clinics have earned the trust of some of Alaska's most vulnerable people.
I have seen firsthand how often survivors of intimate partner violence, domestic violence, sexual assault, and human trafficking access Planned Parenthood and access that through Medicaid eligibility.
Advocates at the roundtable urged Alaska's congressional representatives to vote against the Big Beautiful Bill. The U.S. House passed their version of the bill last month, and the Senate is likely to release their draft in the coming days. The Juneau School District is cracking down on cell phone use in schools. The Board of Education passed a policy amendment Tuesday. Students in kindergarten through high school will not have to turn off any phones, tablets, and laptops and stow them in their backpack or locker for the day. High school students will be allowed to use phones outside of the school buildings at lunch or during free periods. Previously, the district's phone policy left decisions about whether students could use phones to principals. The change comes following a change to state law that requires districts to adopt a policy that limits phone use during the school day. And restricting phones in schools is part of a nationwide trend. The policy change passed 4-2 with members Amber Fromhurst and Steve Whitney opposing. Whitney said he disagrees with students' freedoms being limited.
Our country's based on freedom of speech and also privacy. And I think those foundations need to be enforced and or need to be introduced and instilled before people are adults, while they're young.
Board member Emil Mackey said he agrees with Whitney philosophically, but he believes phone use in classrooms harms students.
I think that there really is a problem from online bullying, from distractions in the classroom, to the inability to from students to concentrate, to falling test scores.
The policy allows staff to search students' phones if they have reasonable suspicion that the student is breaking a rule. The board debated the legality of that provision. City Attorney Emily Wright said the policy is legally sound and pointed out that educators are allowed to search backpacks and lockers without a warrant. But Wright suggested turning to other districts' policies for wording if members felt the policy violated students' privacy.
But I think that if you are unsatisfied with that language, there are many, many, many schools that have been grappling with this, and we can help you find better language that feels like the right balance.
In a district survey of more than 700 students and teachers, only 22% of respondents said they would support a stricter policy or total ban on cell phones in schools. The policy allows for exceptions if students use devices for medical or translation purposes, in case of emergencies, and if teachers give permission for educational purposes. Laptops are also allowed in class for instructional purposes. And a group of state lawmakers is set to meet this summer and fall to continue working on ways to improve Alaska's public schools. Lawmakers passed a bill last month boosting the base of the state school funding formula by $700 after overriding Governor Mike Dunleavy's veto. The bill also made a variety of education policy changes aimed at boosting student performance. But Senator Jesse Keel, a Juneau Democrat and one of the six lawmakers appointed to the task force, says their work isn't done.
This is one of the biggest expenses that state government has in Alaska. It's really important to do the best we possibly can for our kids. And also, always, to do the best we can with the public dollar.
The task force created by the school funding bill has a sprawling mandate. The law tasks the group with analyzing state education funding, student achievement, accountability measures, health insurance, student absences, school maintenance, and more. Lawmakers included the task force in the bill in an effort to win bipartisan support from lawmakers and, unsuccessfully, from Dunleavy. One co-chair, Sitka Independent Representative Rebecca Hemshute, says it will give lawmakers a chance to look at some ideas, like Dunleavy's proposal for inter-district open enrollment without a fast approaching deadline.
We needed to bring folks along who had ideas that are definitely worthy of a look, but were too big to take on in the legislative session. So rather than say no to something that could be a good idea, a task force is an opportunity to study that idea with experts over time and give it a more thorough vetting.
One of the two minority Republicans on the task force, Saldana Representative Justin Ruffridge, says he's hoping to hear a wide variety of perspectives during the task force's 2 years of meetings. He wants to hear experts, government officials, and teachers explain why Alaska's public school system languishes near the bottom of national rankings.
I think some of that is due to, you know, reduced funding over the course of the last decade or so. But at the same time, it can't just be, you know, a money only solution. I think you have to start looking at some of the reasons why Alaska is struggling to keep up with other states.
The legislature's task force announcement comes as Dunleavy weighs whether to reduce education formula funding in the state budget. He said in Fairbanks Tuesday that he's planning to release his line item vetoes this week. The task force is scheduled to convene in August and meet once a month during the legislative off-season. It's required to produce a report with its recommendations by early 2027. And researchers say it's clear that wolves in parts of southeast Alaska are increasingly turning to the sea instead of the land for food. But now there's evidence that that behavior can have toxic results. As Avery Elfelt reports for the Alaska Desk, the finding has implications for the apex predator and other species across southeast.
Gretchen Roffler is a wildlife research biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. In 2020, she was studying wolf predation patterns in southeast, including on Pleasant Island, near Gustavus. A wolf pack in recent years had taken over the island, decimated the local deer population, and started feeding on sea otters instead. The finding at the time underscored coastal wolves' adaptability amid environmental change. But then one died. Roffler explained the situation on a hike during a recent visit to Haines, where she owns property and sits on the board of a local trails nonprofit.
And we found her in a hole under a tree. She had lost about a third of her body weight. She was emaciated. And we were trying to understand the causes of her death. And so we sent
a series of tests on the animal ruled out a range of diseases, Roffler says. What did show up, though, were elevated levels of mercury, attributable to the wolves' marine diets.
And we learned that the mercury concentrations were really high. So they were many orders of magnitude higher than other wolf liver tissues that had been analyzed in other parts of the world. So that was a big red flag.
The finding kicked off a sweeping study that examined the extent to which different wolf packs rely on marine prey for food and how that diet might affect their long-term health. It also weighs whether glacier loss, which is accelerating with climate change, could be exacerbating the issue. The researchers looked at a handful of areas, including Pleasant Island, where wolves are now largely eating sea otters instead of deer. They also looked at the Gustavus mainland, where wolves mostly eat terrestrial animals but are increasingly relying on marine prey. In a paper published earlier this month, they concluded that the wolves' increasingly marine-heavy diets are exposing them to higher mercury levels, which can be toxic. Roffler says some mercury is not uncommon in predators with marine diets, like fox and polar bears.
So we know that this happens. The thing that was unusual in our study was the severe mercury concentrations in these wolf tissues, such that
the study has implications for wolves and other species beyond that one area. That's the case particularly as sea otters proliferate along Alaska's coasts. The species was hunted to local extinction during the fur trade in the 1800s. But then, in the 1960s, the state reintroduced them to the region. The marine predator is now common around areas like Glacier Bay National Park.
We can assume that as sea otters continue to recolonize parts of their former range and grow in numbers, that wolves and other terrestrial predators will start using them as prey.
Ben Barst is an assistant professor at the University of Calgary who studies ecotoxicology. He co-authored the report. Barst says mercury ends up in the ocean in a few ways. First, humans release it into the atmosphere via activities like coal combustion and gold mining. But in Southeast specifically, there's another potential source, glacier runoff, which holds mercury and is increasing with climate change. Once mercury enters an aquatic environment, Barth says, it easily contaminates living organisms like mussels, clams, and sea urchins, and then makes its way up the food chain. So by the time a sea otter becomes wolf prey, they can deliver a big dose to the apex predator.
We see this in other instances with fish. You know, small fish are getting eaten by larger fish, which are getting eaten by the biggest fish, and they tend to have the highest mercury concentrations in these larger, older predatory fish.
Barth says the researchers initially assumed that high concentrations of mercury in wolves could be unique to the Gustavus and Pleasant Island area. More research is needed to determine whether that's the case. There's uncertainty regarding the contribution of glaciers and how wolf diets might flex over time. But it's increasingly clear that wolves across Southeast are tapping into marine food webs, Barth says, which means it's possible the trend could play out elsewhere. In Haines, I'm Avery Elfelt.
And Ketchikan's tribal government will soon be under new leadership. The Ketchikan Indian community announced on Friday that Emily Edenshaw will be their new CEO. Edenshaw is currently the president of the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage. She previously worked for the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. KIC has more than 6,500 federally recognized tribal citizens. The tribe's attorney, Steve Hartford, served as the interim top administrator before Edenshaw was hired. The tribal government said in a press release that Edenshaw is Yupik and Inupiaq from the native village of Imanok on western Alaska. The press release said that Edenshaw's husband is from Haidaburg, and she was adopted into Haida Gwaii's Raven Thunderbird clan. Gloria Burns is KIC's tribal council president. She wrote in a press release that Edenshaw has, quote, a love for elders and education, as well as a passion for economic sovereignty. Edenshaw is set to officially step into the role in August. And as for the weather here in Juneau, it's 51 degrees, and we've started to see some rain tonight. It looks like there's a 100% chance overnight with a low of 46 degrees. Tomorrow, it looks like we'll still get some rain before 10 a.m., and then it might dry up a little bit. You're listening to KTOO.